So, like you said, this word is being thrown around a lot, and it's being thrown around so much that it seems to have lost its meaning. And so many companies who are not just making garments, but all sorts of consumer products have realized that this has become like a buzzword or like a big trend. Companies who are far from being sustainable or far from any kind of concern for the environment are also trying to say that they are sustainable. But if you ask me, I think even I'm not sure what this means, and I'm not sure if I use it so often anymore. Earlier I used to, but I would prefer the word slow instead of sustainable. I would prefer the word conscientious.
Hello and welcome back, you cheeky little monkey, to another episode of the podcast. And I dedicate this to all the monkeys out there, because I really do think that monkeys have been given a little less credit than they are due, because a lot of them are in our urban landscapes. They kind of jump in. Just the other day, a couple of monkeys sitting on the bed. Now, they were actually in the balcony and they were eyeing breakfast. And I was like, shouldn't I? But there's this immediate reaction to shoo away monkeys, right? Because they're carriers of rabies. But so are we. If we get bitten, we are also carriers of rabies. So interesting how we can be more inclusive, because the DEI initiative is about diversity, equity, and inclusion. So just because we are separated by a few genes doesn't mean we are exclusive and separate these ancestors of ours or these genetic counterparts who are maybe not as genetically advanced as us, and not giving them enough opportunity and access to society and resources. So it's an initiative I'm working on. And if you want to be a part of it, I'd like you to be a part of this initiative. It's called Dance Monkey. And yeah, it's a fun thing where we want to kind of celebrate the ability and the opportunities and the past of these monkeys who've been separated and discriminated against. So yeah, all kind of monkeys, not just one particular thing, because again, sort of subsects, you know. Anyhow, we love buying shit online. I love buying shit online. Just the other day I was like, wow, I would really like this shirt, then it turned out to be expensive, so I ended up buying 15 shirts, which added up to the same price as that one shirt, and I felt so good about myself because I was like, I have 15 more than just that one. Yeah, and have you caught yourself doing this when you want to buy a shirt and suddenly, like, if you like this shirt, you might like a condom? I don't know how that suggestion even comes up on Nykaa or Amazon, but it always comes up for me. It's like, if you like this condom, you might like a fire engine. Yeah, it's, I don't know, just the connections are mind-blowing. But yeah, one thing leads to another. Next thing, you have like six packages coming home in discreet boxes, so they don't know the difference between the block printed stretch jeans and the fire engine in a beautiful red and these spotted dotted pieces of rubber and the condoms. So yeah, we end up buying a lot of stuff, and then we don't know what to do with it. We don't know when to wear it, and we just get into this dilemma of, oh my God, I feel so fat. And that's how the day ends, and you go to sleep, and then you again are scrolling online, and you end up going down the spiral of ordering something else or just adding to your shopping basket. And then reading an article on how our rivers are fucked, our atmosphere is polluted, and we are breathing in microplastics. So how do we get out of this trap? I mean, are we just saying the right things? Are we just using and spouting these terms like sustainability and conscious fashion and consumerism and companies doing the same thing? To talk to me about this and talk to you about this, I've got Isha Priya Singh, who's a designer who's graduated from the National Institute of Fashion Technology, but she's presently involved in slow fashion and cultural sustainability. She's here to talk to me about all the various aspects of this movement, the symbolism of it, the execution of it, the nuances that are involved in Western countries, in developing countries, and the underlying currents that determine something like this. Very fun conversation for all of us who are basically just hooked onto this idea of social media, influencers, and shopping, and aspirational kind of ambitions when it comes to owning certain brands and looking a certain way. So I'm excited for you to listen to this because I had a lovely time chatting with Isha. As always, I appreciate you being a part of this podcast journey with me on the Soapy Rao Show. Do give this a listen, a like, a share, a subscribe, and whatnot. Give it the whole thing and the kitchen sink, my friend. And do wait for that initiative for the monkeys. It's coming your way sometime very, very soon. So as always, thank you very much. And without further ado, here's my conversation with Isha Priyasingh. Thanks. Isha, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. It's a pleasure having you here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Excellent. Okay. I'm going to start this off by asking you a question, which is about a concept that is being thrown around very often in today's world of fashion, and especially when it comes to consumerism and the way people are shopping and the way people are looking at resources in the world of fashion and, of course, the world of, consumerism. And that's the word, concept of sustainability. So could you, in your opinion, let me know what sustainability means to you in the work you do?
So like you said, this word is being thrown around a lot, and it's being thrown around so much that it seems to have lost its meaning. And so many companies who are not just making garments, but all sorts of consumer products have realized that this has become like a buzzword or like a big trend, and they need to ride on that, or they need to do something to tell their customers that they are not far behind in terms of following this trend. And so it's being used a lot, and companies who are far from being sustainable or far from any kind of concern for the environment are also trying to say that they are sustainable. But if you ask me, I think even I'm not sure what this means, and I'm not sure if I use it so often anymore. Earlier I used to, but I would prefer the word slow instead of sustainable. I would prefer the word conscientious instead of sustainable, which means that we have been consuming everything, be it food, be it content, be it, popular films or music and everything, so to say, not just clothes and consumer goods. We have been consuming at such a pace that we just need to slow all of it down. And if we can slow it down, we will automatically become more mindful and conscientious. And then we will be able to think what the impact of our consumption is and minimize that impact, because we know that this kind of consumption is leading to great damages to the environment. And that ultimately is not a threat to the planet, because the planet is going to survive. It has survived several disasters, calamities, and huge events, the planet altering events. But it's important to understand the impact for the survival of the human race and survival of the life as we know it today. Because as we know, if the resources that we are using to consume, to create so much, to manufacture so much, produce so much, and then consume it, if we run out of those resources, then it's ultimately our life that is going to be affected. The planet will find its way.
Right.
So
you use the word slow, right? Which I personally think is great, but why would someone care? Because when you look at the way the mass produced products, and I think the word in this case is when the fast fashion companies, as you said, are using these keywords to seem like they're gearing up towards a more sustainable, a more eco-friendly future, they use these buzzwords because, you know, someone like H&M would release a sustainable line, or they would say made up of recycled products or renewed from certain waste plastics or whatever it may be, to kind of seem like they're kind of fitting the agenda of sustainable, a sustainable future. But when you look at something which is done more ethically, which is the people manufacturing the products have better working conditions, they have fair wages, or the products or the resources used are more are sourced more sustainably. They're kind of the materials are also being used more consciously, and as a result, the end product is quote unquote sustainable. It's eco-friendly. It lasts longer. As a result, you can be more mindful of what you've bought, and you don't have to buy as much because you don't have to buy a fresh pair of jeans or a new dress because it's the new fashion, or it's already torn because it's made out of bad quality materials, or it's done in a more sort of factory environment. So why does this matter to the consumer, right? Because why would I sitting here when I've got like a Myntra sale or an Amazon Great Indian Festival sale where I can get a pair of jeans for 500 rupees versus something which is ethically sourced and made, which costs 15,000, but it lasts 10 years. Why would it make a difference to me as a consumer? Because as you said, the planet will outlast us. Now, the thing is, in our society's eyes, progress in life is seen as an ability to consume more. The more clothes you have, or the latest fashion you're able to kind of don, or the newest brand you're able to sport. And as you become richer or perceivably seen as more successful, these brands play a role, right? Whether it's, you know, wearing certain brand of jeans or certain kind of shoes or certain dresses or certain watches. All these come with a sort of social conditioning that has been kind of instilled in us, that the more you can consume, especially of a certain brand you can consume, as you become more socially mobile up the ladder, it's seen as a sign of success or a sign of social progress. So how do these things translate to a social message besides the environment? Of course, the environmental impact by fashion, the fashion industry is huge. But today, how does someone sitting there swiping through their phones, being bombarded by ads, how can they even think, okay, 10 years down the line versus, man, I can get this dress right now in one day delivery, I can get this particular product delivered home. So how do you kind of balance that human greed, human desire versus the longer goal of, hey, you know, if I buy this, it lasts longer, and the impact I have, negative impact I have on my immediate environment or the rivers which are being polluted, is mitigated because I'm buying something which is sourced better and made better.
So like you said, that the issue is directly related to the human greed, or if we don't want to be that harsh, we could say that it's linked to the human need of being perceived as more successful in life, and to be more comfortable, or to be happier, to be enjoying life, you know. And so this is so deeply related to this flaw in human behavior, if we like to call it so, that it's really difficult to make people understand or to make them change their ways. It's difficult for us also, like people who are talking about sustainability and about mindful consumption. Sometimes it's tough for us also, because there are so many options in the market, and the market and the entire system is designed to make you buy more, and it is designed to sell you things in a way which is not sustainable. Let's say in terms of the packaging that it comes in, or in terms of the way the supply chain is designed. But so that is the reason that there's a lot of talk around sustainability, and people want to believe that they want to live sustainable lives. But I don't think this is something that's been internalized. Mm-hmm. I know that many people who used to follow my work and regularly appreciate it and say that, you know, we have learned so much from you, and we have changed our ways, and you have made us introspect and all of that. I can see that after a few years of doing it, they have gone back to doing what they used to, and they no longer engage with my content. And they have probably realized that it is the idea of living a sustainable or a minimal life that attracted them, but they are not naturally drawn to it, or they don't find resonance with it. They feel they are not happy doing it. So there was a recent post on this page on Instagram called the Sustainable Fashion Forum. And I keep following their content because it presents some insightful studies. And it says that there is a attitude and behavior gap. There is a gap between what people believe who they are and who they actually are. That is why they do want to care for the planet, because they want to appear, probably they want to appear aware, or they want to appear, woke, if you'd like to use that word. Yeah. But do they really believe in it? We don't know, because there was a talk that I held here in Dubai. This was 4 years ago, before COVID hit the world. And this talk was about sustainable fashion and sustainable consumption. And I had somebody attend the talk, and this person was from Egypt. She went through the whole talk and she said, but, I just want to know where I can shop from. Mm. Who are the sustainable brands I can go and shop from? And I said, that's the whole idea. The idea is not to tell you one brand instead of the other, to say that, okay, don't shop here and go there. The idea is to say that you have to stop shopping as much as you're shopping if you really want to. Mm-hmm. But that is something that is so difficult for people to internalize.
Because my wife, as I told you before we started recording, she runs an e-commerce platform, and she has used to have these pop-ups in Bangalore, right? And a few other cities as well. And you would have a profile or a demographic of people coming. And as you said, right, they would resonate with this idea of sustainability. They would sit during the panel discussion and they would ask the right questions, or they would nod at the right moments, or they would say, seem like they were, with the program. But they would just leave not buying anything, and then probably go and buy a dress from Folio or something, right? Like, which is completely nothing wrong with it, but it's like walking the walk and talking the talk, right? It's very easy to use these keywords, these hashtags, but at the same time, when it comes to it, they're like, my God, one dress is this much? So as you said, one aspect is buying less. The other aspect is buying something which costs more but lasts longer, because there is this idea, use the word slow. Slow has a negative connotation. It's almost like you're missing out. You're not being able to catch up with society, or you're not in the sort of the trend of what people are doing, and you're kind of this fear of judgment, right? Oh my God, I'm wearing, very superficially being judged for wearing the same shirt for three parties or whatever it may be. And how do you change that, right? How do you change the idea from fast being a good thing, which is you're ahead of the curve, you're kind of ahead of the pack, versus slow, which is like almost seen as lazy?
I think this is something which also depends on the individual and where they are in life and how they feel about life, because like you, we speak about this particular Maslow's hierarchy in marketing terms and in psychology, right? And that is completely based on consumption. Yeah. That you could be at the lowest level in the pyramid, and then you might have a lot of needs. And as you keep climbing up in life, and then you reach a stage where you want self-actualization. And that is when you grow above and beyond all the basic, or probably the created needs of the world, and then you will move on towards more spiritual pursuits. Mm-hmm. So I think that this also applies to generations. This also applies to different countries and the way their societies are placed at the moment. Probably countries in the Western world, in Europe and in USA, or probably Australia. I don't know so much about them. I've never been there. But from what I understand through popular culture and through what we hear in the news or what we see of them on the social media, their society has been consuming at a faster rate and for a longer period as compared to those in the third world, probably.
Yeah.
So they have now reached a stage where they have consumed so much that they are bored of it, and they have come to realize that this is not the answer. As you know, this famous quote by, I think it's by Jim Carrey, who said that, I wish everybody would just get rich and famous so that they realize that that's not the answer.
Yeah.
So probably they have, as societies, they have reached a place where they have consumed so much that they are completely done with it, and they've realized that it is not making them happier and it's leading to so many other problems. So they have started thinking about these things more and more. But in a country like ours in India, I can see that, you know, there are so many people who are still aspiring to consume and to own so many things. And I'm not sure if we will have to go through that whole cycle of consumption, the whole country, you know, and the different people coming from different kind of socioeconomic backgrounds will have to go through that whole cycle of consumption to realize that, oh, we were, you know, we were mistaken or we were misguided and this is not going to make us happier. But sometimes people don't realize, like I said, it applies to individuals, society. To generations. There are generations who grow up in scarcity, like probably my grandparents' generation, who was the greatest generation. It participated in the freedom struggle of the country. It saw world wars. It saw so many struggles, and then so they valued things more and more because things were not easily available to them. They were also brought up in they fought in an environment for their rights where they realized that consumption and colonialism, the way consumption was in that phase, in that period, this colonialism has brought so many problems to us. Colonialism was actually nothing, but it was a kind of consumerist culture, right?
Yes.
So they had seen all that and they looked at things very differently, and they tried to bring up their children in a different way. But when those children grew up, which is my parents, India got liberalized when they were in their mid-age. And they suddenly realized that they could go to a showroom and immediately get so many clothes that earlier they had to wait for somebody to go abroad and bring for them. Suddenly, you know, there was so much packed food and they did not have to make achar or they did not have to make namkeen at home, and they could just go to a market, supermarket, and they could get it. So I think that was something that completely changed with the generation. And with our generation, of course, we grew up with Coca-Cola re-entering the market and, you know, so many malls opening up and departmental stores coming up and McDonald's opening its outlets. And so it grew and grew and grew. But as you know, we are reaching now, a couple of other generations have come in, and now we are seeing that they probably are looking at things very differently because they are looking at the future very differently. So there are so many different aspects at play here. Generational consumption, as a society, the way it's moving. And of course, you know, in terms of countries and how resources are divided, of course, even today, I would say that Europe and the USA, the first world countries, they are consuming so many more resources than the third world countries are. And that is what becomes like a topic of contention at a lot of climate summits and meetings as well, that they are telling us to stop consuming so much energy or to not use coal, and to, you know, reduce our carbon footprint, while at the same time their per capita carbon footprint is much higher even today. So it's yeah. it's a complicated issue, and I don't think there is one straight answer to that. So
it's like someone who's had a full stomach their whole life telling someone who's never seen food, "Hey man, stop eating so much." You identify two important things, right? One is the process, and I think it's really key to understand that it's a process, because if I've grown up from a young age having everything I wanted, then by the time I'm in my late teens or my early 20s or whenever that realization occurs to me, like as you pointed out in America, you're like, "Hey, what is this doing? What is this filling up in this void I call through consumerism? What is it doing? It's not really doing anything." But if you've never had, it's not possible to someone like me who's had everything to go something, "Dude, don't buy those jeans. You know how much damage it's causing to the environment. Buy ethically made, sustainably sourced materials." Yeah. And because, you know, the factory workers, they're like, "I don't care about the factory workers in Bangladesh. I've never been able to afford a pair of brand new jeans out of a bag." So there's a joy in buying something, right? So as you said, if you're sitting from operating from two different places, these are very two different conversations for both these people. But what is the second aspect of this is the judgment, right? Someone who's had everything judging someone who hasn't, telling them that you're indulging in fast fashion and over consumerism, because that's where the conversation sort of ends, right? Becomes pointing fingers, saying because of you, very conveniently forgetting how much you've consumed, right? So if you kind of mesh these two parts together, there is kind of the future can only be that, you know, we all go through a cycle of consumption and realization, and then hopefully have a place of non-judgment from where we look at others who are going through the process and kind of, without criticizing them, at least guide them through it, so they can, if it took me 20 years to realize that, you know, hey, what I'm buying is really hurtful to people, it's really hurtful to the industry, to the environment that the industry is polluting. So if it took me 20 years, it's probably my responsibility to kind of help someone get through the process in maybe 10 years, and for that person to get the next person through it in 5 years. And that's the only way, because there's no abrupt way. If you sit on your pedestal and say, you people who are consuming stuff on Amazon, Great Indian Festival, you're horrible to the environment, that's absolute rubbish. Because I've had, if I don't know if privilege is the right word, but I've had the opportunity to realize that I have a choice here. And choice is a very hard thing to come by for many people in this world. So
I completely agree. Yeah.
No, so I want to understand your journey, right? Because you're not typically in the fast fashion or in the textile space, even though you have branched out to it. So can you talk about your journey of how you chose within the space of jewelry design to kind of embark on a more sustainable path and kind of discover more a slow way of doing what you do?
Yeah. So if I start from childhood and from early life, I think, like you said, the word to be used is privilege. I was highly privileged because I had the privilege of buying new outfits for my birthday, for a special occasion, for weddings, or probably even for festivals. Of course, everybody used to at that time. Festivals was the time when people mostly indulged in shopping. So I grew up with a lot of clothes, and I used to love dressing up, and that's how I decided to go into fashion, if not clothing, jewelry, because I wanted to do something different. But I always loved clothes and I loved dressing up. So when I reached campus and I started my life there, I realized that because it was Ahmedabad, Gandhinagar, it's a fairly hot place. And I was a student, so I had limited resources and there was no time, actually. The course used to be so intensive. So if you were serious about your education, there was no time to go shopping. And we were in Gandhinagar, which is actually a twin city. And at that time, it had no malls or shopping centers or shops, etc. So one had to commute all the way to Ahmedabad if they wanted to shop. And there was no online shopping, of course. So there was no time really to indulge in shopping every few days, and there were no resources, as in there was limited allowance even from home. So I started wearing these cotton block printed textiles that were very easily available in Ahmedabad. I used to go there to this old market in the walled city and visit a shop and get few fabrics, and then go back home, get some kurta stitched. And my uniform was a kurta and a pair of denim, and with one jhola bag and kolhapuri chappals. So it sorted my life, because I was, even though my peer group was wearing different kind of clothes, they were wearing dresses and t-shirts and stuff. Even I used to wear t-shirts once in a while, but that became my style because it made me more comfortable. And for the climate, it was more suitable. I felt more at ease because I didn't have to worry about, if I were wearing a noodle strap spaghetti top, I used to feel very conscious because of the way things were at that time, the way women were perceived at that time, and how you were judged for what you were wearing. So I felt that, you know, choosing clothing like this would save me from judgment and from thinking too much about what people are saying, and I can focus on my education. So that worked out for me for those years. But as soon as I joined the workforce and got my first placement from campus at this swanky design studio in Bangalore that was working for a jewelry company. It was a jewelry company's design studio. I realized that this college style of, you know, casual kurta and denim is not going to work for me here, because here the environment is different and people are people expect you to dress a certain way. And it was very categorically also conveyed to me
right.
that you have to dress like a designer, though there is no prescribed way of how a designer should dress. Or and mind you, this was something I was told in my appraisal meeting. So it was serious. And when you're told something in your appraisal meeting, it means that it's affecting your prospects and your career. So you have to be serious about it. And that's when I started going to so many of these big stores at in the big malls of Bangalore at that time, Garuda Mall and Forum, and you know, to all these big, huge standalone stores at that 100 feet road in Indranagar. So it was all crazy, and I couldn't understand which way to go. And I was throwing so much money on these things and still not being able to put one decent outfit together because I just did not feel myself in those clothes. You know, the materials just did not feel right. And I did not even know how to articulate these feelings. I was going shopping, getting clothes, but not feeling good and looking good. And this continued for a long period. This struggle with how I wanted to dress went on for at least 10 years throughout, you know, the period when I got married and then the early years of being married. And I could always feel myself gravitating more towards Indian wear. But there were these preconceived notions in my head that, you know, Indian wear will make me look dated or outdated, or it will make me look like a, you know, quote unquote behenji, or I will not be perceived as somebody who's modern or cool enough and stuff like that. So it was finally when I turned 30 and I had worked for enough number of years to outgrow that kind of judgment at workplace. And I was in Mumbai, which is very different. The climate there is very different from Bangalore. It's so humid throughout the year that obviously I started realizing that I do need to go back to wearing genuine cotton clothes and not the kind of mixed up nonsense cotton that is available in these stores in the malls. And thankfully for me, the online retail had boomed and there were so many smaller indie labels who had started using Indian handcrafted textiles into, like you said in the beginning, more Western, or I would say more contemporary silhouettes.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when I started going back to those textiles. And this was at the same time when social media started booming and Instagram became a big thing, and there were people who were sharing their daily outfits, and I started doing that. This was also the time when I started wearing saris because I questioned my thinking of why should I wait for an occasion to wear a sari. I have cotton saris. I can wear them to work on a casual day, casually. And whenever I would wear saris, I would feel happy in them, and I would ask somebody to take a picture of me and the picture would turn out well. I would put it on Facebook. I would get a lot of compliments. And that's when I started this Instagram page to share my regular outfits. And it started getting a lot of engagement and interest from people. And the more engagement I got, and then finally the followership also started growing, I became more serious about what I was doing there.
Mm-hmm.
And as it happens, because you have a followership and people are liking your work, I started getting messages from different labels and small businesses and resellers who would want to send me some of their outfits, and I would wear them to work. I was working full-time at a jewelry company in Mumbai, and I would just wear them to work, ask one of my colleagues to take a picture and share that. And that is how it kept growing and growing and growing. But after doing this for about 3 years, I started questioning this whole thing because of one particular incident. One thing, of course, was that my wardrobe started exploding, which had never happened. Even while I was growing up in a privileged family where I got so many clothes for different occasions, it never so happened that my wardrobe would ever exceed a certain number of clothes and would start exploding. But this happened in Bombay when I was living there. And I was passing by, I was entering my office one of those days, and at the entrance, there used to be this whole cohort of our office help and people who were working as support staff and the security people. So one of the security people said this, and somebody came and told me that, you know, the security person was saying that, you know, Isha madam jaisi life honi chahiye. It should be like her because she wears a new outfit every day. And it hit me like a, you know, like a, I can't even tell you what it felt like, because instead of feeling happy or, you know, feeling bloated with my ego, I felt like, you know, oh my God, what is this kind of, it took me a couple of days to realize and understand my own feelings. But I thought, oh my God, what am I, what kind of example am I setting, or what is this role model that I'm becoming for somebody who cannot even afford to buy 4 outfits in a year probably. And I'm giving them a goal that they should wear something new every day. So it shook me, and it took me another few months to internalize this. And then a time came when I had to leave Bombay and relocate to Dubai. And that's when I had to pack things up and give things away without even thinking twice, and simply donate them, or, you know, just give them to whoever came to my mind first. And that's when I realized that what I had done over these 3 years was criminal, because I had accumulated so many clothes that I loved. I liked so many of them, and yet I couldn't use them to the fullest, and I had to give them away because I simply had no space to keep them. So that changed something in me. And when I reached Dubai, I had lived here before, but this was the second time. And I realized that this whole city was just about consumerism.
Yeah.
And when, you know, when you look at things from that perspective, sometimes you feel it's a dissociation. It was a dissociation for me completely from the environment. And I just could not connect with the place. That how is this whole place just surviving on the back of consumerism? And all people do here is shop. People, yeah. Tourists who are coming, or people who are living here. And that's when I started reading more and more about sustainability, the fashion revolution movement, the whole Rana Plaza tragedy of 2000, I think it was 13. Yeah.
In Bangladesh, right? Yeah.
Yeah, in Bangladesh. And that is when I started moving away from this whole thing of buying or acquiring, because some of them used to be the clothes that I got from the labels who wanted me to promote their work. And that's when I said that, okay, and I did not stop immediately, but I said, I'm going to start keeping a count of how many collaborations actually I'm doing in a month. And it was just too much when I started keeping an account of that, and gradually started reducing it to 1 per month. And then by 2020, before COVID hit, I stopped. I said that now Desi Drapes is going to cease to be a page for promoting labels or businesses like this. I will not take clothes from anybody, not a gift, not barter, no paid, nothing. And it changed into a whole space. Of course, it took me about 6-7 months. I was blank. I did not know what to do with the page, what to share. I was not doing the OOTDs, you know, the outfit of the day posts every day. So there was, I didn't know. But then it took me about 2 years to find a rhythm, to understand what I eventually wanted to do with the page. I went through these phases of hating Instagram completely, you know, and then completely going, like deactivating the account for a few days. And then again, so there was a lot of back and forth, hate and love. And then now I found a space for me where it's okay. Even if I lose followers every day, there are no new followers. And I know that very few people actually engage with my work now, but I'm okay doing what I'm doing now.
You know, it's not to sound patronizing, but I think it's very commendable to kind of have that realization, to take a step back, especially being in an environment like Bangalore, Bombay, and then Dubai, which is kind of the ultimate sort of sign of, you know, yeah, being there. Like, you arrive and it's consumerism on the back of exploitation, and it's so easy to get sucked in. And the second, I think, commendable thing is, as an influencer in today's day, it's so easy to just get sucked in and spiral out of control, right? Because it's that sense of validation, it's that sense of being recognized for what you do. And it might start out with a certain space that you are comfortable with, which you believe in, which could be As you said, you know, wearing ethnic clothes with pride and kind of branding it as cool or whatever the message you wanted. But then next thing you know, people just saying, she has a lot of followers, let's just bombard her with free stuff. And it's humanly very difficult to get to say no, because it's a free stuff, which plays to our human desire and greed, but it's also the ego, which is like, get more followers, more. So to take a step back is very difficult. So, you know, as someone who's been in the social media space as a comedian and trying to grow the page, and, you know, if you get that one viral post or viral video and you're like, my God, I made it. And then to pull back and take a step back, very difficult, you know. And I think from that point of view, well done. And I think it's not easy. So I think that's a really big example of how someone can actually break away from that influencer trap, if that's the right word, or how to kind of walk that fine line mm-hmm. without going over to the dark side, you know.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about another thing, Isha, is this recognition for the work you do, right? We always seem to recognize the front facing, and by no means am I undermining this, right? But like, say in the world of fashion, we always are, you know, because as I just said a few seconds back, as a comedian, there was this need to kind of look a certain part on stage, and it's rewarded, right? If you come on stage, you know, really shabbily dressed in whatever it may be, it could be in your choice of clothes, it could be Indian, it could be, but even it could be really shabby jeans, unironed t-shirt versus really cool ripped jeans, which, you know, and a designer t-shirt. And that kind of automatically gets you more recognition from the audience for this thing that you're putting up as an act in the entertainment world. And as a result, brands do become something that you aspire to acquire. But why is it that, like, when we look at certain brands, whether it's Indian designers, or say the big houses in Europe, we always recognize the designer, right? Which of course is important because they design the clothes. But can we do more to recognize the people actually stitching those clothes? Because yes, while the design is important, the craftsmanship in making a shirt or a dress or a sari is as important, right? Because it's execution of the design.
Yes, so this is a contentious issue, and again, a very complicated one, because even in the handcrafting sector, because that is something that I'm more involved in, there are designers who are educated at some of these premier design institutes of the country and also international ones. And then they would, because they want to create something, make something, they would go to an artisan, let's say somewhere in Kutch, or maybe even like in my hometown, Lucknow. And they would want to create a line of outfits. So they need so many people to do that, because they would need the whole craft cluster to do the embroidery or to do the printing, or to, even if they're using a handloom fabric, then to weave it. And then there will be other people who will be stitching them into garments and then finishing them. And so it's like a whole army of people who is behind creating even a single outfit. But this is hierarchical. And, you know, just like the company's CEO, in the corporate world, who always gets the most importance, and they are the ones who are interviewed, they become the faces of the company. They are actually not doing all the work alone, right? They have like a legion of people behind them. But they are in a leadership role.
Yeah.
So whoever is in the leadership role, because a designer is somewhere taking the lead, and they are taking a risk by putting out an idea in the world.
Yeah.
So I think they are, whatever credit or whatever benefit they get is because of that leadership role that they have acquired or they have opted for. So in a way, it is valid. But yes, once you are a leader, it is up to you to decide what kind of leader you want to be and how much importance you want to give to your team and how much individual credit you want to give to each and every contributor.
Now, I kind of have spoken about this in other episodes with other issues, which is respect for craftsmanship, right? Because when we look at especially the Indian context, it seems that the aspirational jobs are now, of course, in technology or in law or in medicine or in similar. Now, of course, it's changing with like entertainment and YouTube and influencers, etc. But there is few encouraging signs, right? When you say, even on social media, you look at this guy who takes shoes, for example. I saw this recently, and he kind of customizes it and makes it a really unique pair of shoes that people really covet. And he gives it to these celebrities and he gives it as a gift and they really sort of cherish it, right? Like from the box to the laces, the artwork. He's just really taking existing pairs and making it something else. But it's changing. I suppose there are some guys and gals in India who are trying it as well. But this traditional thing where we look at a carpenter as someone who's just there to kind of build you a wardrobe, even though wardrobe or maybe a bed is something you use every day. But it seems like we want to, if it's a designer kind of a line from which you're buying your furniture, then you'd be okay with paying anything. But the carpenter himself, or I don't know if herself is relevant in India, we don't have female carpenters, at least traditionally, it seems there's not respect for the job. So similarly, like tailors, or in this particular case, tailors, so if we change the kind of perspective, right, because designer is a cool thing to do. You go to design school, you become a designer. That's when you get invited for the fashion shows and the social engagements and the art gallery launches. But very rarely does someone say, I'm a very, popular tailor. I mean, what is the connotation? Because can we through context, cultural conditioning, change that? Because take pride in things like being a good plumber, being a good carpenter, a good electrician, or going a good tailor, because there are people who made careers out of it in the West. Because while we did criticize the consumption patterns in the West, there are certain things that we can kind of learn from them, right? Because being a house framer, someone building a house, is given as much respect as someone who's a teacher or someone who's a mental health expert. And yes, there are trends there as well, which there's a disparity in, but a basic level of respect that does exist there where it doesn't exist over here.
Yeah, in India, actually, we have two factors that affect this, though I'm not an expert to be speaking on this, but caste and class. Right. Caste is something which is a huge factor when it comes to the perception of people who are involved in this work. Because there were different communities of people, like there were Prajapatis who used to make the pots and the pottery, basically. They were the potters. So everything related to clay and terracotta was their domain. But obviously, they did not have that kind of caste mobility.
Right.
And there are other communities as well who work with certain materials. So in India, in South Asia, we have this... we have caste as a factor which has deterred them from growing to a certain level because they've not had that privilege because of caste. But again, I'm hoping that things will change and I can definitely see some change coming in because there is this whole concept of Shilp Gurus that has been introduced. And in independent India, there have been these special awards and meant to encourage such master craftsmen. And I recently had the pleasure of meeting one of these highly decorated craftspeople. He is a Leheria master craftsman. He's artisan. He's a Shilp Guru. And he's got several precedent awards for his work. His name is Badshah Mia. He's from Jaipur. And he's invited to several events. And he's also one of the mentors for a school that I'm working for. This school is called Indenium School of Responsible Design.
Nice.
So there we have multiple such people working for us as mentors. And they are highly respected. This is something one can see in Kutch. If you go to Kutch, there are craftspeople who are so revered and they are considered, they are almost like celebrities because there are people from the Western countries who are working with textiles and they have textile schools, they are writing books, they are researchers, they have brands. They visit them nearly every day. If you visit some master weavers in Bhujori, which is a village near Bhuj, or if you go to Ajrakpur, where the craft of Ajrak is practiced, you will see that, these people have no time because throughout the day, they don't even have time to work on their craft because they are meeting people every day who are visiting them from so many countries. So they have a celebrity status. And recently, when I was in Kutch, we the Indenium School of Design had a convocation for the students for the last batch. And we invited master craftsperson, Dr. Ismail Khatri, who is an Ajrak craftsperson, to come on stage and present them with their certificates and awards. So I think things are definitely changing. Of course, it differs in different parts of the country. It differs with crafts, which crafts were, of course, perceived as the, because I'm sure there is a hierarchy even there.
Yeah.
What kind of work is considered lower and higher and so on and so forth. So things are changing. And of course, you know, education, because of so many years of not getting that kind of mobility and privilege, a lot of craftspeople cannot speak English. They cannot use social media the way the other people can, the designers can. So those are also things, you know, in our country, language also becomes a marker of how you are perceived. It becomes a sign of, you know,
being able to transcend those boundaries.
That is a barrier. So those barriers now, of course, there are craftspeople who are educated. They can communicate in English. They have made their own social media handles and they are regularly sharing their work there. Social media is a big equalizer in that sense, because even people who cannot speak English can make pages there and they still find followership. And so I think it's something which social media can help craftspeople gain a certain status in a big way.
Which is encouraging, right? Which is, shows the other side of social media, not just the influencer trap and this thing. And and it's encouraging to hear these craftsmen and craftswomen getting so much recognition and being able to pass on their trade, because it's unfortunate. You mentioned the Indian potters, right? Not getting any recognition, but you know, if you look at it, like a potter in the West got a book written about him. That's a terrible joke, Hari. It's a Harry Potter reference. And anyway, forget about it.
Oh, yeah.
there is hope for the potters.
That's a brilliant book.
I'm sorry to, you know, I was just waiting for you to, you know, give me your wisdom on all these things, just with this stupid Harry Potter joke in my head. But no, I think there's so much hope for the craftsmen. And I really want a future for that, right? Where, you know, my daughter Stu, and she comes and says, I want to become a craftsperson, it should be given as much consideration as like, oh, I want to join a course in microbiology or whatever it may be, right? Because there is this thing where we're like, no, there's no place. But with this power of social media and the ability to transcend geographies and languages and class and boundaries, I really think this is something we as individuals going forward, recognizing the power of that, can leverage as opposed to and leverage and encourage, as opposed to just this aspect of celebrity worship that social media endorses and kind of sucks people in with, you know? So I think examples like yours are really, really important for people, because right now it's either social media, you become an influencer, or, oh my God, social media, you have mental health. I think there is a certain aspect of it which needs to be strengthened and kind of also used to help people kind of break these various things that could be holding them back. So what's in store, Isha, for you over the next few months, and for people listening who want to follow your work and also kind of are inspired by what you've done and aspire to kind of go down the path you have, what can they look forward to?
I am going to relocate to India very soon.
Okay.
Even in like in probably a month's time. So I'm very excited for that, because I think the fact that I spend nearly half the year in India, but because I'm the last 5 years, there's a lot of work that I have not been able to do, because every time I would start something, I know it's time to go back. So now if I am going to be in India for good, I know that I can travel a lot more to the craft clusters to understand them better. And I can work with a lot more craftspeople and also other stakeholders in this field. And also not just understand several nuances and aspects of cultural sustainability, which is coming from the way our previous generations have lived or the way things are produced traditionally in our culture, but also look at sustainability at a larger level where things are not coming from a cultural milieu. They are coming from, let's say, the whole idea of there are these large-scale factories and manufacturing units that are not inherently sustainable, but they are going to be there. They are going to function. How do we make their functioning a lot more mindful and conscientious? So I would want to engage even with that aspect of how things are made, not just textiles, but, and I'm hoping that at some point I will be able to go back to jewelry, because when I relocated to Dubai, that is when, I mean, I was doing my jewelry design work, and I was also working on in this particular field of, you know, garments and textiles. But when I moved to Dubai, I had to give up jewelry for certain reasons. But I feel that now if I go back to India, I'll probably be able to go back to it and restart my work even in that field. So I don't know. I don't know what the future holds, because we make a lot of plans and then those plans sometimes don't really work out the way we would have imagined. So I'm just excited that I'm going back home, because I think I feel the best when I'm in India, nowhere else. And Dubai definitely has been a tough run for me, because here I don't feel connected to the environment, to the place, to the way people live here, to the way anything. I mean, there are very few things that I like about Dubai. I will not say that I don't like anything at all. There are things that one has to appreciate, but I don't feel a connect. So yeah. I feel that if I, when I reconnect with myself and when I'm back, I'll be able to think better and there'll be more ideas flowing in. And I would love people who have been through this journey with me and have seen me grow since 2017-18. I would love them to share their feedback on what I should be doing. Because honestly, of course, like I said, social media is very important in today's world. And I've had a love-hate relationship with it. But I know that there is no way you can survive without it. But there has to be a mindful way of using it. And the space is definitely oversaturated. If you're not making reels and if you're not sharing videos, then your work is not really seen by many people. But I would want to stick to my way of doing things. And within that, I'd invite more people, like I said, people who've been on me with me on this journey to suggest and to give their ideas as to what more they'd like me to do.
That's, I think, an amazing thing for you to embark on, right? To find this sense of connection with yourself. Because if you don't start there, then there's no point kind of trying to find a connection outside. Because you kind of just go in all directions. And I think we all try to plan, but I think sometimes the plans are not what, they don't work out the way we expect, but they might even work out in much larger and much more unimagined ways, which I think is the beauty of life. So I think on behalf of everyone listening and myself, I think good luck with your journey. And I think, it's been great, the work you've done. And I really appreciate you taking the time, sharing the wisdom, sharing your experiences, your opinions, and your learning along this journey. So thanks so much for your time, Isha. Really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you so much for this conversation. And I love conversations like this, because they help me understand my own thoughts better. And the way you guided this whole conversation was really, really nice, because there were so many, sometimes, you know, we are talking about something, but we are not being able to phrase our words or give words to our feelings. But you helped me with that. And, you know, because you yourself have been engaged with this segment of the clothing and the textile manufacturing, which is slow and mindful production. That's why I think it was even more interesting for me to share my experiences with you. And yes, one thing that I do have as a concrete plan and something that I'm going to do is that I'm going to learn spinning yarn on a charkha.
Nice.
Because that is one thing that I have been wanting to do for a very long time. But the way things have been unnecessarily complicated in the khadi sector, it is very difficult to get your hands on a charkha and to learn to spin. But I started learning in Bhuj one of those days when I was there. I learned a bit about spinning, and I'm now better placed to understand where I can get a charkha. And so I'm hoping that when I go back, I'll be able to get my charkha and I'll start spinning on a regular basis. And with hit and trial, I'll be able to learn and get on with it. Something that I'd been meaning to do for so long.
That's brilliant. All the best with that. And thank you for those kind words. And, you know, I think I did it all just to crack that Potter joke. But besides that, good luck. You know, I hope you continue finding your way with spinning yarns on the wheel, and I'll continue spinning my yarns here on the podcast. So thanks, Isha. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you like what you heard, please do check out the other episodes on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. And I would much appreciate it if you could like the video, share it with people who you think might enjoy it. And of course, do subscribe to the channel, because it will help me and the podcast grow and reach more people just like you. So thanks again. Appreciate it. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you like what you heard, please do check out the other episodes on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. And I would much appreciate it if you could like the video, share it with people who you think might enjoy it. And of course, do subscribe to the channel, because it will help me and the podcast grow and reach more people just like you. So thanks again. Appreciate it.